never turned off the fast AGC. So I'm anxious to hear how it's going to sound with slow AGC in the circuit, not fast.
Okay. My recommendation is to experiment. Basically, there's no way of learning better than trying it to see which sounds better to you. Is what sounds better to you, or the peculiarity of your radio may be different than mine. I'm just giving you the standard advice, which may not always be the best.
Okay, AC2GS here. I might point out an interesting thing that I discovered many years ago that was kind of the basis for probably my first mailbag question that I sent in to John to ask Dick. That I already figured out that a lot of legacy supergenitive, superheterodyne, and radios have their S-meter wired to their AGC level, so that as you change your AGC level, your S-meter responses will change, which always struck me as weird, because I could make my IC7100 read an S of 9 or an S of 2 just by enabling the ATC. You can't do that with my flex radio because SDRs actually take legitimate measurements, calculate the DBA or the S signal level. But that goes hand in hand with a lot of legacy radios, that depending upon how you're adjusting the ATC level will change what the S meter results for the same exact strength signal will be shown to be.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I think I have the same radio as Rich, the Kenwood 440. And I do work a lot of CW, and I just always leave the AGC on slow. You know, the button's all the way on the right hand side, I just leave it out. And when I go to a phone, I just leave it that way. I just never change it. I always leave it on slow. Anyway, back to you, Rory.
Okay, I guess it's what you're used to and what you're using for, since I operate. Occasionally I play around with digital types where I switch out the AGC entirely. When I have the AGC on, it's for single sideband. So I find personally for me that a fast ATC works the best for what I'm doing. But, that's why there's change. There's a setting that you can set on the ATC. Very good.
DBH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I found also with ATC, pretty much for sideband and CW, I think they had recommended that to leave it on slow, because in sideband you don't really want your AGC responding to each syllable. You sort of want to follow the average signal level, and the same thing with CW. You don't want your gain or your receiver bouncing up and down with every dot and dash. You want to more or less average it out, so that's why they recommend the slow. Incidentally, the only receiver that I have found over the years that is the most accurate for S-meter readings as far as the 50 microvolts being S9 and 25 microvolts being S8 and so forth is my old Bodanker SX117. I put that on a calibrated signal generator. And it was pretty much right on the mark, 50 microvolts being S9. So, some of these older receivers, they were pretty good at following that standard. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, for whatever reason, earlier models kind of were adept at taking legitimate numbers. I don't know exactly when the turnover or redesign where they linked it to the ATC, but at one point or another, they just got far easier probably less expensive. But I mean, that was the thing that confused the heck out of me. I was just getting into the hobby, and I had my ICOM 7100, and I could change people's signal strength. It dawned on me that that's probably not a good thing. I shouldn't be able to adjust people's signal strength based on their signal, not on my radio. But the ICOM 7100 and the slew of modern radios all have been tied to ATC. As far as using slow ATC for voice, I guess ultimately it depends on how fast your fast ATC is. As I mentioned on my Flex radio, I kind of settled to use fast ATC all the time, and I've never really heard any clipped syllables. So I don't think, at least in the case of the Flex radio, the fast ATC is quite that fast.
Well, like on CW, if you're listening to CW, I guess you don't really want the background noise welling up when the station you're listening to is key up. If it's on slow ATC, it'll sort of average out between each bit saw to give you like an average S meter reading. Whereas if you have it on fast, the S meter will be following each. Now, on my Japan radio company, my NRD515, it says specifically the S-meter is calibrated when the RF gain is full. The way it backs off RF gain is by varying the ATC voltage. So it says specifically for calibrated S-meter readings, RF gain must be at full.
Well, it's very nice that they inform you, because most people are blissfully unaware, and they'll take S readings from all these modern day radios without much kind of underlying understanding of what not all S meters were ever created equal per se. Some are better calibrated than others, but some are kind of just works of almost competence on it. So it's good that they, I would hope and expect that the Japanese engineers would include that little bit of information, because I think they really have a pride in manufacturing these things. But I think over the decades they've let that lapse, and there's a lot of people out there that think an S-meter just does what their S-meter does.
Yeah, I'm really sorry JRC got out of the amateur radio business. They're only in the marine and aeronautical, mostly in the marine electronics now. They used to be in the amateur radio business. They had a couple of nice receivers, the NRD545, the 535. There were some very nice receivers, but they stopped their whole amateur line, and now they're exclusively into the marine electronics. But that's the way it goes.
RW2DZ?
Yes, Rich.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Paul on his 440, do you feel that your meter, your S meter, is very, very stingy?
Really? No, I've never thought of it as being that. Naturally changes if you change the automatic gain. If you push that in and out, you'll see moving real quick, like they were saying before. But, I hear signals sometimes very good, and I can barely see the S meter moving. But then when they start coming in strong, the S meter moves okay. So I just assume that, the signal is just either weaker or stronger. I think the radio is good at picking up weak signals. Just like I hear audio signals either on CW or on phone when the S meter is barely moving. Is that what you mean, Rich?
Well, basically, I mean, I can hear a signal which is, to use an analogy, almost full quieting, and I'm looking at an S5. I don't think I've ever seen a 10 over S9 on this radio in the 35 years that I have it. And I thought they were known to be stingy on their S-meter reading. But, like I said, for all these years I've kept in the fast AGC, I'm going to try it both for CW and phone to see what slow AGC, what's the difference with, you know, using slow AGC over fast AGC.
Yeah, you'll probably see a difference. I would say, you know, if I got a strong signal come in here, you know, I'll see that meter, you know, go over 20 over. No problem. You know, if I see a local station on 80 meters or something, you know. If I go to W1AW, when they transmit a CW, that meter goes, I'd have to look at it again, but that meter goes way up, you know, from Newington, Connecticut, Rich.
I wonder if all these years I've been looking at low meter movement because of the AGC. We'll see. I'm not even going to do it tonight on 20 meters and see if it makes a difference. If it does make a difference in the reading, the S-unit reading, then that's not right either, right? If a guy's coming in an S9, he should be an S9 whether it's fast AGC or slow AGC.
Okay, understood. Now you got me thinking. Next time I turn this thing on, which maybe I'll do it on 80 meters later tonight, I'll do the same thing, except I'll go, instead of slow, I'll go fast and see what my S meter does. Now you got me curious. But, to do it right, I would need, you know, an ICOM or a different radio, just side by side, then I could do a real good A-B test, but I don't have that. Oh, question.
Sure, John. Let me see if I have it. We are talking about single sideband signals, right, where the signal level is always going up and down with the syllables of speech. So if he's peaking S9, the meter is going to not bounce up and down so much on the slow with the slow ABC. But if he's peaking S9 and you put it on fast ABC, then you just see the meter hit S9 and go right back down in between the syllables of the speech. Go ahead.
Well, again,
I always thought that the fast AGC was the more accurate reflection of the signal. Now I'm learning no.
At the front end, it wouldn't have any effect. What happens is a lot of different radios use a lot of different methods to cut corners, and that's not really what we're measuring on our S meters often.
Roy, I doubled with you. Let me see if I have them. Yeah, what I said was I thought the fast AGC was the more accurate signal report than the slower AGC. You know, instantaneous signal report. That's why I've always kept it on fast. But it's got my curiosity up, and tonight I'm going to tune around with it on slow for the first time in like 35 years. Back to you, Roy.
John, did you want to say something? I think we doubled, maybe even tripled.
Yeah, the fast and slow AGC refers to the time constant of the AGC. It should still peak up to the same, let's say if it's an S9 signal, it should still peak up to S9. Okay, it's just that with fast AGC, it'll peak to S9 and drop back down quicker, which means that the gain of the receiver will come back up between syllables. with slow ADC, it'll peak to S9, and then the time constant in the ADC loop will hold the ADC voltage, keeping the gain of the receiver lower between syllables of his speech, so that you won't see the meter following every syllable of his speech. It has to do with the time constant that's in the ADC loop. Go ahead.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm just trying it out now. I'm looking at a receive signal on 3.548. You know, guys on CW. And if I push that button in, which goes over to fast AGC, the meter does drop. So there is a difference. And then I put it back on slow, and the meter comes up. I definitely think there's a big difference. Not a huge difference, but, you know, a couple of S units anyway. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Let me just make sure I have the repeater. Okay. Again, unfortunately, I think the thing that isn't the constant in all of our cases is the design of our radio. In some old models, they sense the RF signal stretched out of the front end in a way that doesn't change depending upon the gain circuits of further stages in the radio. And digital SDR radios, I think, work on that principle. So if I change the RF gain, I'm going to get the same signal strength, because it's not reading the signal strength into the detector, it's reading the signal strength into the radio. So it sort of depends upon what design the radio has, how all of these factors affect the presentation of the so-called S-meter signals. We've all kind of been taught through the years that you take S numbers with a grain of salt, and in the case of contesting, you just make it up. Every one is 5.9. Okay, I think we discussed that. We still have loads of time. Anyone out there with any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk. I'm sure there's got to be some guy out there somewhere with either a question, a topic for discussion, or a comment, or perhaps you were on the technical net in the past, something was discussed, and you're going to try it, see how it worked out, discovered something, but you haven't had an opportunity to come back and tell us how it worked out. So we're open to learn things as well as inform people about things. So if you're out there and you got something for the TechNet, hit that push to talk.
W2PC.
Yes, Rich.
There's something else I'd like to know. Why did they say, and everybody says this, do not use an antenna tuner, whether it's internal to your radio or external, with a mag loop? I still don't understand why they're emphatic that you do not use an antenna tuner with a mag loop. Do you know, Roy?
I think I know. The big problem with magnetic loops, as we've mentioned in the past, is the quality of great importance in a magnetic loop. It has a very high Q, so it has a very narrow bandwidth. But one of the big things is its radiation resistance. The standard half-wave center-fed dipole in free space has a radiation resistance of approximately 73 ohms. When you take it very close to ground, it kind of plummets and approaches approximately 50 ohms of radiation resistance. In the case of a magnetic loop, the radiation resistance of that resonant loop is less than a tenth of an ohm. The problem with that is any insertion losses as part of that chain
will be a source of inefficiency. In other words, if you have that center-fed dipole that has basically close to the ground 50 ohms of radiation resistance, and you introduce 2 or 3 ohms of insertion loss via an antenna tuner, well, that's peanuts. That's what, 6% loss, maybe? If, on the other hand, you have a loop with a radiation resistance of a tenth of an ohm, and you introduce 2-3 ohms of insertion loss by putting in an antenna tuner, you basically use most of your energy at the antenna tuner. So that is the reason why separate antenna tuners are frowned upon. The impedance matching, resonating, should be done at the level of the loop with the capacitor, the variable capacitor. It should not be downline in an antenna tuner unless you want the efficiency of your antenna to be less than 1%.
Okay, so it's the insertion loss that the tuner... Well, what about an internal antenna tuner? Is there insertion loss there also?
Yes, they're the same circuit. They're just in a slightly different place. You're introducing inductors and capacitors that are designed to transform an impedance, and they have connections internally. They have small but non-zero insertion loss resistances. You know, every screw together component introduces another small amount of insertion loss.
Okay, well, if that's the answer, now I understand. Why? Because you're dealing with very low power to begin with, so you don't want anything to detract from the power. I understand it now. All right, thanks, Roy.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, so Rich, if you want, I'm calling CQ on 3.540 now. I used your call sign. I'm calling you. But if you want to test it out, you know, I know you'll hear me on 80.
Okay, 3.054?
Yeah, 3.540. 3.540, I'm on.
Right, oops. I forgot my low end 80 meter frequency. Okay, 3.540. I will listen in.
Okay, are you able to transmit out with that mag loop?
Oh, but I can switch over to my NFED half wave, and I'm able to. I have to bring in the external antenna tuner, but I'm able to transmit doing that. So let me first see if I can hear you. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, don't go through that trouble. Yeah, let me just send CQ.
Am I? Yeah, no, Paul, I can't hear you. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, I can't hear you. Wait a second. Hold on a second. Try it again, please. No, I still can't hear you. We'll try the experiment another time. I don't want to hold up the TechNet. Back to you, Roy. Go ahead. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, no problem. I figured no problem with 80 meters. Okay. Roy?
Okay, ACQGF here with the live on Technical Net. We're still open for business, so if anyone has any questions or topics for discussion or comments, please feel free to hit that quick talk button.
November Quebec 1 uniform, John.
Yes, John.
Yeah, good evening. I came across Lichtenbrock, a German engineer a while ago, and we have from him today, as most folks I guess know, LITC lip wire, which is multiple wires in it wrapped together so that the skin effect is distributed. I'm going to let it drop for a minute. Yeah, this is NQ1U. So my question is, if the skin effect can be distributed across many wires, why, and get more efficiency, why don't we use this wire as a sensor conductor for coax?
Okay, that's a good theoretical question that hopefully someone with an electrical engineering degree has a good answer for. Among other things, it's probably expensive, and it's probably a more delicate material to use as a sensor wire. I don't even know if it would kind of survive manufacturing, if you could effectively pack it together and still have it have the functionality that it does in the form of it's generally produced. If anyone is familiar with lit wires and why no one would use them to design more optimum coaxial cables using it as the center wire element of a coax. Because, you know, I don't really know that much about lit wires other than the history.
I don't know much about that subject either, but... get through with this question, I may have something for them as well. Casey, too, has an interest. So.
Maybe you were confused because the other person is John as well. So the person who asked the question is NQ1U John, and you're another John. Anyway, once again, this is ACTGS. Again, don't really know the answer to John NQ1U's question. I get the sense that no one out there tonight does either, but we'll ask one last time before we give up, I guess. And it means I'm going to have to go search Google to figure this out. You know, again, my gut feeling is that lit wires are expensive and difficult to maintain, and simply would not be a long-term strategy for coaxial cable manufacturing. I'm just taking a guess at you. So if anyone knows better, please feel free to type up. John, what can I tell you? I think we rolled snake eyes tonight. I'm sorry.
This is NQ1U. Well, yeah, I just came across this and thought it was kind of a strange question, and I appreciate you trying. Thanks a lot. I'll send it back to Ness. This is NQ1U.
Like I said, I'm going to do a bit of Google searching this week. If I find something interesting, I'll probably bring it up again next Sunday. So thank you, at least, for participating. I hate it when we don't have a good answer. It'll be interesting to see if I guess right or wrong. Anyway, thank you, John. And which takes us to another John, KC2SHO. Hello again. Long time no here. What's your question and your comment for tonight, John?
Yeah, Roy, sorry for the confusion. Cooking dinner and kids have the TV loud on in the living room and you're a little noisy in the system too, so I just wanted to make sure it sounded like maybe you were asking if I was in there. But yeah, my question for the net is first, a preliminary question is, would we agree that a bird watt meter is a type of direct just with a very a configuration that makes it very portable and useful. Would you agree with that assessment of the bird 43 watt meter?
Yes, I would, John. I think a bird watt meter is the reason why it's almost a universal symbol for our hobby, and a lot of us have it. I'm sitting within about a foot and a half from my bird watt meter that I bought from John Casey, 2WGB's estate. If you ever go to QRZ and look up Casey, 2WGB, the site is still open. And there's a picture of an enormous number of test equipment, and on the shelf is five bird watt meters lined up in a row, and I own one of those today. But yeah, I think it's very useful. It gives you a change in range for a more accurate assessment of different power levels. You can take the forward, reverse the slug in the opposite direction, take the reverse, and know what your reflection coefficient is, know what your SWR is. It could be very useful, and it feels like a tank.
Yeah, real good. And, you know, I've been using bird watt meters and directional couplers for many years. You know, I've worked in the RF profession. I have a very good understanding of transmission line theory, I think. Although it always comes more than learned. I'm still learning from the archives, of course. But my question for you is, are ham radio operators misinterpreting the information in the BIRD 43 manual? Or is my understanding of a directional coupler not quite complete? Because throughout all my career, I've never seen a broadcaster worry about how many fractions of a wavelength where they put the directional coupler. The equipment could be broadbanded, covering several hundred megahertz without concern about where the placement of the directional coupler is for reverse power measurement. But many ham radio operators will tell you that that text in the manual that talks about the one-half wavelength piece of coax, they say you have to have that piece of coax in order to get a correct reflected measurement reading. Now, when I read that, I don't think that's quite what I am understanding. So I was hoping that you could clarify what that paragraph means and why it's there. ECTGS from KC2SC2.
Okay, here's another one where I really wish I could pull out an electrical engineer. As far as my understanding, it sort of depends upon the degree of mismatch. The closer to a match system you have, the position of the transmission line will have less of an effect as far as rotating impedances. We've discussed in the past that I've had weird cases where I was unable to tune my 10-meter antenna with an antenna tuner, but by extending the length an extra 30 inches, it rotated the impedance to another section of the Smith chart that allowed the circuits of my impedance tuning circuits to deal with it and to normalize it back to 50 ohms. So I'm thinking it's a matter of degrees, it's a matter of obsessive compulsiveness, that probably following the directions would give you a somewhat more consistent, somewhat more accurate assessment than just using it any old place, any old time. So, I guess it's the difference between an engineer type or a technician type and just some amateur radio operator who wants to spitball.
Yes, sorry, I had to clean my hands up there for a second.
Yeah,
I bet I can find something in the archives maybe to enlighten us on this, but it's, again, I've never seen any RF engineer, and I'm going to ask them now. I've never had them tell me that I needed to do that with a directional coupler. And, of course, we have very high-end directional couplers sometimes. Sometimes the directional coupler itself is worth more than the entire price of the 43 watt meter and all the slugs, you know. 3 megawatt transmitters that run part of the accelerator here in Los Alamos, they don't. The directional couplers, I don't believe, are that critically placed in the line. They're just placed where it's convenient. So, just kind of some clarification on that. But real good work. Thanks for your explanation. I'll try to dig deeper. Maybe I can come back with a better answer next week. KC2, DS from KC2, SHO, John, in Los Alamos.
Yes, well, very good, John. If you learn some more, I'm building a list. I got two things to look up for this week. One is loop wires, and the other one is directional couplers and the length of transmission line. Yeah. I mean, transmission line theory can get really cute. There was a point where John, KC2WGB, started to talk about a waveguide book. You know, there was this such waveguide theory that I found it on Amazon, a used copy, and I bought it. And it was very reminiscent of the time that I started to thumb through a advanced antenna theory for graduate students book. You know, that sense that any moment you might get a nosebleed. So, you know, I think like most things in science, it's kind of the onion skin effect, that you learn one layer, that you sometimes learn another and another and another, and eventually you kind of know that there's a lot more layers that you just don't have the heart to kind of peel away and figure it out.
DDH with a comment.
Yeah, certainly, John. What I think happens sometimes is there is a bit of a misunderstanding between voltage reflection and power reflection. If you're sampling forward power and sampling reflected power, you know, with a directional coupler, it shouldn't really make any difference where you put it. Now, if you're trying to look at the forward voltage or reflected voltage, if you happen to stick it at a voltage, a point in the line, that might cause some confusion. But again, the confusion is between what people see as the total voltage, which is where you're going to get your maximum and then your minimum, the forward voltage and the reflected voltage alone, separate, don't cause maxima or minima to occur in a line. It's the combination of the forward and reflected that causes the standing wave where you see a peak and a trough as you move down the line. So I think that might be one of the things that causes some confusion. Okay, that's possible. Well, what do you think, John from Los Alamos? We have three Johns now.
Yeah, that's a good point and a very valid point, and it made me think, well, maybe the bird is just a detector, not a power meter. So therefore, even though it is a directional coupler inside, if you're only taking that and putting it into a detector, is that only getting the voltage detector than the power meter of sorts. So maybe someone who understands more about that, maybe that's the key. Because if we're only sampling voltage, then it makes sense. Like you said, if you're on the voltage anti-node, anti-node, then you would have the highest voltage and then the position would matter. Okay. Well, something to think about for sure, but if someone knows the answer, pass it on to whoever might know more about this. AC2GS from DC2
and CW. WD2IKT.
Yes, please.
Okay, yeah, good evening. This is George WD2IKT. And I spent quite some time as a master control engineer over WLIW Television, Channel 21, where we had a Klystron operated transmitter with, going into an antenna with an effective radiating power up to the area of 5 megawatts. Klystron's final voltage was 25 kV and it could run up to 10 amps. And the rest of that power was antenna gain. And we, in fact, had directional couplers on a 6 1/8-inch transmission line that typically, when we used it, we had it built with Freon for quite a while. This was in the mid-80s. And, you know, where you put the coupler, and I think that's part of the question, it depends on what you want to measure. Are you concerned about the antenna itself? Get a better match to the transmission line, but most of us would say, yeah, that's something we want to do. And then sort of say why, and the reason why is that you want to protect the final amplifier, your transmitter, from the bad effects that a high SWR would have. So you wouldn't be so far.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Then what I was going to say is that if you look at that plug on the bird wattmeter, it's a portion of your directional coupler, and it goes into something more complex than the diode, right? So it's measuring the voltage in that coupler. It's really, you know, it's an RF voltmeter, and directional coupler there built into the plug determines your meter reading. Of course, it's the length of the directional coupler, and the diode and so on. A very, very broadband affair. But it's definitely voltage sensitive. It's not measuring power. In order to measure power, you need a barometer, which is going to basically heat something up in your thermistor, basically, and then you're going to measure how hot it got. And that's actually how you're going to measure the power. Bird wattmeter does not actually measure power. But
no, that's probably why sometimes I perk up when I hear ham radio operators say that, because my entire experience, and I've tuned directional couplers, large ones, small ones. I've ordered them, specced them out, but we're almost always connecting them to power meters, you know. Different types of power meters, of course, but it's always been a power meter that's going to give you a dBm reading. So, probably my lack of experience with the birds and the fact that I've used too much higher end equipment is where I was having trouble putting together what I hear all these ham radio operators say, which concerned me a little that it wasn't correct. Maybe it is correct, and I need to broaden my understanding a little. Thank you for that.
Okay, just to finish, you know, just because it's measuring the voltage, you know, the scale itself is measuring how much power that would represent on a 50-ohm line. But the reason for your SWR is that, well, things aren't quite 50-ohm all the time. It depends on exactly what frequency and how many wavelengths and so on. So it's a voltmeter, but it's measuring power. It's not just measuring the voltage, but it's giving you a reading of power. Make sense, Roy?
KG2RY.
Yeah, David recognized. Yes, George, I understand. And thank you. Hopefully, John from Los Alamos has a better indication of where to look for reference material. You know, I think the problem is that ultimately a lot of values we take for granted are inferred from other data. And as you mentioned, the ultimate power reading device is a thermal one, where you just generate heat, measure the amount of heat, and that's ultimately the power. The rest are much more dependent upon other variables that you're making assumptions about.
And I believe that's correct. And in fact, if you look at, I'll use the word Stuart Patrick, I know it's Adelaide, and then, I don't remember who it came from, but their line of power meters included, in fact, we're measuring power from a kilometer, which would give you an accurate power meter. That would be their 431, 435, which I use quite a bit. They had directional couplers in them, but it wasn't going to a diode and a device measuring the voltage and then reading it out as what the power would be. It's actually measuring the power as the result of the temperature rise, which is a more accurate reading thereof. Right.
Very good, George. Thank you. I appreciate it. And, hams kind of depend upon their equipment. It's passed on from ham to ham. And so it's always good to kind of have a better grasp of what's going on and what's truly being measured. And, again, biological systems have been using cutting corners for hundreds of millions of years. So electronics certainly works on the same cost to benefit ratio. So I thank you, George. David, you wanted to say something?
Yes. Thank you very much, Roy. Good evening, everybody. All this talk about directional couplers, and I have this as advertisement for a used E.F. Johnson Viking Matchbox ham radio antenna tuner and coupler. And the coupler, and you enlarge the picture, and it says directional coupler on the device.
Okay.
QSL. It's like one of these things that will basically tune anything, and the only downside to it is you only get the regular ham radio bands, 10, 15, 20, 40, 80, 160. You don't get the warp bands on it. But specifically, the directional coupler, what is the purpose for that?
I would assume that it is part of the SWR calibration. That's how you know that you've reached the endpoint, when your reflections are as low as humanly possible.
Well, on the back of this device, their connection for some kind of parallel, some kind of ladder line that would come in. Some of the ones that I looked at that have conversion for SO239, and I'm wondering if a direct coupler has anything to do with the upgrade to SO239. I know that the impedance of a ladder line is different than the impedance of a coaxial cable.
There are two ways. Let me just check that I have to receive. Okay. The ACTGS. There are two ways that antenna tuners deal with balance line. The modern, inexpensive way is to simply pass it through an impedance transforming balance. The finesse way, that was the old way, was to actually have not simply one pi network as your impedance matching circuit, but parallel pi networks. So you were actually had a balanced impedance transformation going on when you connected the ladder line. So the old time repeaters where, money was almost no object, has parallel PHY networks, whereas if you crack open a modern-day antenna tuner that had an input for open line, you would just see a small ballast in, as part of its input chain.
QSL, Roy, thanks. It's enough information. I don't think I'm going to buy this unit. I think if I would get one, it would be the PALSTAR because there's coverage, more coverage. I have another question about receiver noise and how to determine whether the receiver noise from a battery is less or more than a modern switching power supply. Go ahead.
Well, to me, the best approach is to just do an A and B a substitution and see what you hear. You know, we talked in the past about World War power supplies can sometimes introduce noise into the system, and the best approach to kind of remove that totally from the equation is to operate via battery power and see if it goes away. If it doesn't go away, then it's not the power supply, and you don't have to worry about things like that. You know, power supplies are an interesting topic for discussion, especially, I think, on 75 meters. A lot of old-timers remember, unfortunately, the early days of switching power supplies in which the filtering systems were not really up to it, and it did introduce a noise and raise the noise floor locally. I have not found that to be the case in my 11 years in this hobby. I initially bought an Alinco switching power supply. One of its features was that you could offset the switching frequency so that if you had a problem, you could tune it around the problem. I never needed to turn that knob. I upgraded it to a much more powerful but still a switching power supply. I like switching power supplies. They're relatively smaller, they're more efficient, and they're less expensive. I recently played around with a World War power supply. Almost every World War power supply out there is a switching design, but I specifically looked for a linear-based World War, and these things are heavy. They're a couple of pounds, whereas most World Wars are ounces. It was a little bit on the expensive side, not terribly. It cost me, I think, $30, but you can get Woolworths for about $10-$15. And it was very inefficient. At least 40% of it went up in heat. The amount of power it sucked up and the amount of power that you could draw from it was only 60% of the total power of input. So I'm a big fan of switching power supplies. There are people who don't agree. And I say that's why you got choices in life.
QSL, Roy. I was looking at those Astron linear power supplies. They're really big. They're really heavy. I don't know where I would put one. And so I did a test just to see, you know. I had four different frequencies, 7.150, 7.250, 14.200, and 14.306. And I tested the received noise from first hooked up to the power supply, and I used the low setting, the lowest noise setting, the one in the middle, and the one that's the highest or the loudest noise setting. And I did the same thing with the battery. And the difference, you know, was so minimal, you know, it was insignificant. So, you know, I guess this little Jetstream power supply, it does the job, you know, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, you know, this is exactly what I have found in the 11 years that I've been toying around with these things. And by the way, I got the linear World War to see if it would solve a problem with my LP500 watt meter, and the answer is it didn't. Is there something weird about my LP500? The USB connection seems to spit out some kind of USB-based noise that didn't play well with my desktop and caused me to reboot the USB circuits in the desktop. I eventually just moved the USB device to a separate computer that seems to get along better with it. But I have found I love switching to power supplies. I'm a big proponent of them. I understand that some people are a bit wary from the old days. One of my first memories when I went to the King County Radio Club was some guy telling horror stories that he was told about guys plugging in switching power supplies to oscilloscopes and showing them how noisy the power supply was. But, you know, who knows what year that was, and who knows who made that power supply. It's lost in the dustbin of history. So I'm a big proponent of switching power supplies, and I pretty much use them. You know, if you need an anchor, you know, if you got a boat or something and you don't want it to drift around in the ocean, then, yeah, Astrons would make great anchors. But, you know, if you like, Astrons are wonderful design. They're built like tanks as well. So if that floats your boat and you got space, I don't have space for any of this stuff. I need a small, compact shack in my house. You know, you don't have the room to spread out across the floor.
Same here, Roy. I don't have space for a lot of big boat anchors. But just to conclude, I think it was like what somebody told me. He said that the newer switching power supplies are quiet enough in most cases. The older ones might be different.
Well, yeah, like I said before, the problem at any time people introduce new technology, there's a certain amount of time in which they have to readjust the specification because they often get them wrong. This is all over the place. As bizarre and completely different as digital television, high-resolution television first came on in broadcasters, they had to redesign space and makeup because everything looked fake and phony because of the higher resolution. There were things you couldn't get away with. The same thing, we've talked about it more than a few times here on the technical net, when the shift from analog audio to digital audio came on. There were a lot of peculiarities of engineers understanding the strengths and weaknesses and making the proper adjustments. So the same thing happened with switching power supply. The initial design probably aired and allowed a little bit too much noise into the power output, but I think it certainly over the years has been corrected. And, you know, you could count hundreds of thousands, millions who have bought switching power supplies and don't really have any problems with them. Occasionally, you'll have a misbehaving woolwart, and you'll have to deal with it. But that's just the nature of some electronic devices are built faulty. You know, nothing has 100% quality assurance, unfortunately.
VDH with a switching horror story.
Yes, John, please, feel free.
Yeah, this occurred, I would say, a good solid 10 years ago, probably around 2010, 2011, maybe even a year or two earlier. My next-door neighbor had a laptop or a computer, and he would leave it plugged in on its switching supply permanently. And it was wiping out 20 meters and 40 meters for me. I was getting loud 60 cycle noise all over the band. I hooked the audio up to my scope,
And when I put the scope on line sync, the waveform stood still, so it was definitely power line related. And I called a gentleman at that time, Wilco, and he traced it down. I forget what his name is, but his name has been mentioned on the net here. Anyway, he traced it down to her her switching supply, and so she, yeah, I think she has since sold it. But it, again, switches since then have been much, much quieter. Incidentally, I have an Astron RX-12A. It's powering my my Kenwood right now, as a matter of fact.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you. Yeah, I think the designs have gotten better. The quality control has improved somewhat. And so, you know, I hear less horror stories nowadays. Kind of the thing that tends to skew the most RF are people with solar battery arrays and inverters, because it seems to be relatively easy to cut corners when it comes to the electronics for the solar arrays and the inverter circuits and some of those.